Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Food Security and a 2-Degree World press briefing. At this time, all lines are in a listen-only mode. Later, there will be an opportunity for questions, and instructions will be given at that time. If you need assistance during the call, please press star and then zero. This call is being recorded and will be available for replay beginning at noon Eastern time today through Sunday. You may access the recording by dialing 800-839-2486. And international callers should dial 402-220-7223. I'll turn the call over now to our moderator, Ms. Ellen Wilson. Please go ahead.
Thanks for joining this briefing, and good morning from here in Washington, D.C. I'm Ellen Wilson from Burness Communications. This briefing will address the challenge of feeding the world's poor in regions most vulnerable to climate change. Five of the world's experts on food security and climate change will discuss the scope of the problem facing food production in developing countries and promising new solutions for addressing and preparing for climate change. We will also announce a new program, a collaboration between the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research, also known as the CGIAR, and the Earth System Science Partnership, which will address the nexus between climate change and agriculture. I'd like to cover a couple of logistical matters before we start. First, the online press room is at the following address, http://ccafsandsam.org/content/press-room. The press room includes a press release on the new program, links to speaker bios, contact information for seeking further one-on-one interviews, an audio recording and transcript of the call as soon as they are available, and other background materials, including events, dates and events for COP 16. So the way we'll handle this call is that the speakers will present the remarks, after which we'll have a question and answer session. The speakers today will be Dr. Bruce Campbell, Director of the CGIAR Program on Climate Change, Agriculture, and Food Security, and we call it CCAF within the field. It's located in Copenhagen, Denmark, and he's joining us from Copenhagen. We also have Dr. Andrew Juan Chalinar, who is team leader under the CCAF program and also a lecturer at the University of Leeds. We have Dr. Andy Jarvis, who's leader of the Decision and Policy Analysis Program of the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, or CIAT, located in Cali, Colombia, and he's joining us from Cali. We have Dr. Philip Thornton, senior scientist at the International Livestock Research Institute, or ILRI, located in Nairobi, Kenya, and he's joining us from Edinburgh. And then we have Dr. Jerry Nelson, finally, but not least, he's Senior Research Fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute, or IFRI, located in Washington, D.C., and he is joining us from Washington. So now I'd like to present Dr. Bruce Campbell. Bruce, go ahead.
Thanks. I thought I'd just start off today with making three points, one related to the new program, one related to how one will work in the face of ClimateGate, and one related to the upcoming COP 16 in Mexico. So firstly, on the new program, the globe essentially faces a daunting task in terms of climate change and what the likely impacts on agriculture and food security. Current situation in terms of poverty, malnutrition, hunger is already unacceptable in developing countries, and the predictions are that malnutrition could go up 20% if we don't deal with climate change. That's the adaptation side. On the other side, on the mitigation side, agriculture contributes some 20% of greenhouse gas emissions. So therefore, it's a major part of the problem as well. So we have to see agriculture as a solution as well. In relation to these kinds of challenges, the CGIAR has now decided to make a major investment in a research for development program on climate change, agriculture, and food security. So we're going to see something like $200 million over a three-year period. The proposal is this would be a 10-year program. It's going to bring adaptation and mitigation together. It's going to bring the best climate science scientists together with the agricultural scientists. And its success will be measured in terms of outcomes, not in terms of scholarly articles. The kinds of outcomes we're looking for are high percentage reduction in poverty in the target regions in the order of 10% perhaps, and reductions in emissions from agriculture in the order of millions of tons of carbon. The second point relates to new ways of working. The climate gate really shook the climate science world. It reduced the credibility of scientists, and one could see that one really needed a new way of working. And so from day one, we intend to engage with the users of the research so that the products are directly relevant to the users, so that the kind of language that we use is understandable, and that's so we can build trust, essentially, between the science community and civil society. The third point relates to upcoming COP16 in Mexico. So this really is the first major activity of this new program. All the international negotiators are coming together in 2 to 3 weeks' time to see whether a climate change a global agreement can come out of Mexico. For agriculture, it's really a crucial negotiation. Currently, although agriculture contributes a fifth of global emissions, and although the impacts of climate change on agriculture and food security are immense, agriculture is hardly part of the current global policies. What we're hoping to see is that agriculture gets on the agenda. There's a small bit of text related to having agriculture as a work program. This means the door opens for agriculture, and then agriculture can be fully incorporated in the future global agreements. As part of the program, we will host something called Agriculture and Rural Development Day. It's a day-long event. It's really an attempt to raise the profile in agriculture, attempt to delineate the exact action that is required in the next 3 to 6 months' time in order to get agriculture on the international agenda. We expect some 500 persons, and we hope that it raises the profile of agriculture in terms of getting on the negotiators' agenda as well. Thanks. That's all for me. Thanks.
Thanks, Dr. Campbell. Our next speaker is Dr. Andrew Chalinar, and he'll be representing the Earth System Science Partnership, or ESSP, the other partner in this new program. Go ahead, Dr. Chalinar.
Okay, thank you, and good afternoon, everyone, or morning, as applicable. First of all, to say that Rick Gleemans, who chairs the Earth System Science Partnership, would have liked to have participated today, but is, as we speak, traveling. So I am a sort of stand-in representing. I've been working in the ESSP community for 10 years currently at the University of Leeds, but I'm also a joint theme leader with Andy Jarvis on one of the themes within CCAFS. And I really just want to say three things, just a little bit first on about the ESSP, the Earth System Science Partnership, a little bit on climate science in general, which will touch on maybe some of the issues Bruce raised about Climate Gate, and then specifically on the CCAFS program, and in particular the CG, IAR, and ESSP partnership elements. So ESSP is essentially a network of researchers. I'm not going to say much in detail about the ESSP, but it is significant work has been carried out by the ESSP community on climate and its impacts, and this is very much from a point of view of understanding the Earth system, the interactions within the Earth system, the kind of issues that are critical for linking adaptation and mitigation, for example, the kind of movement of carbon within the Earth system. And just a couple of sort of very specific examples from ESSP initiatives. First of all, GCAS is a program on global environmental change and food systems that looks at food systems and food security. So begins to take the ESSP away from just a food production kind of approach, an element. And secondly, a program called START, which is has done work in capacity building in developing countries, developing links between the north and the south, offering fellowships and masters and PhDs. So those are two of the initiatives that are particularly relevant to CCAS that are existing within ESSP. Secondly, I just wanted to say a little bit about the importance of communicating and understanding uncertainty, and this, as I've said, is relevant to the issue of climate gate. So recent misconceptions regarding climate prediction and the way in which things have been communicated and presented have caused trouble for the global change research community. And I think there's an increasing awareness of the need, not just for rigorous assessments, but to be really to communicate the rigor of the work very clearly and to assess very clearly how robust the research results are. So one of my interests in particular is on quantifying and communicating uncertainty, so understanding how robust the statements we make regarding climate and climate change are. And we know that climate prediction is inherently uncertain, but we do know that there are a number of robust statements that we can make within that, and that rigor is central to work within this field, within sort of the official ESSP boundaries and within the broader community. And I think that the CCAS project means that the broader CGIAR community can benefit from the wealth of work that's going on in this area. So that brings me to my third point, which is the tremendous value of having the CGIAR and the ESSP communities involved in the same project, in this CCAS project. The project really does bring together research and development partners, climate scientists, livelihood experts. So it's really about research teams, each with their relevant experience, but bringing them together in an efficient way. And to my mind, that really does, CCAS really is unique in that respect. Let me just give you an example, a more sort of concrete example that I'm familiar with, and that's making climate models more relevant to agricultural livelihoods and studies of agriculture by asking what is the information content of these models, at what spatial scales and at what time scales can we make these robust statements, and having a conversation with a really real two-way partnership and conversation with those who are interested in using that kind of information, so that we're addressing technical issues and pragmatic issues at the same time. So, and in conclusion, really, it's about putting the underpinning science to use through dialogue, so that it's not just a case of those interested in agricultural impacts of climate change taking whatever the climate model output is, whatever is on offer, and making the best of it, but actually uses the fact that some people really do love to get into the guts of these models and improve the models and really improve the state of the art, and others like to be more hands-on, and by bringing those groups together, we'll get towards the outcomes that Bruce mentioned and make sure that those outcomes are based on state-of-the-art scholarship. So I think that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Challen. Our next speaker is Dr. Andy Jarvis from the International Center for Tropical Agriculture. Go ahead, Andy. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good morning and afternoon, everybody. So I was just thinking here of giving you a little description of some of the emerging science that we have that's been coming out from recent research that we've been doing here in CEAT, and that is forming an integral part of this new program in CCAS. So we've been looking kind of with a global view to the impacts of climate change on agriculture. And we've been looking at this idea of what is the climatic potential to produce food across the world. And so there's a lot of studies on some of the major crops, you know, wheat, rice, barley, etc. But what we're looking at is a much broader range of crops, like 50 crops we've selected that are the most important across the globe, and trying to understand how climate change into the future might impact on that productivity. And so what the emerging pattern that we're seeing is that globally to 2020, there is actually a moderate increase in the climatic potential to produce food across the globe. Which is also agrees with some of the results from the IPCC fourth assessment as well. For 2050, there is actually a decrease of 5 to 10% that's coming out of this study. And most of the initial gains, over the short term, many of those are in the Northern Hemisphere. And so we have today a big problem of food security due to distribution problems, access to food. It's not that we're not producing enough quantity, but many of the high poverty regions don't necessarily have access to that food. And so globally what it shows is that there will be greater inequity in terms of food production, meaning that there will be more requirement for food distribution to enable access to the poorest regions. The real devil is in the detail when we look at the crops and the geographies. So I thought I'd just give you a few examples. We have the Indo-Gangetic Plains, for example, where really you have these rice wheat systems where you have rice production cycle for 4 or 5 months, and then farmers harvest the rice and grow wheat. And so, for example, in wheat, they're producing 90 million tons. Which is essentially the breadbasket for the 600 million people in India. And so if you look there, you have a very interesting pattern. You have, for example, with rice, if you have, assuming that you have enough irrigation, which at the moment there is, although groundwater is a major issue there of how sustainable it is. But, for example, with rice, the climatically it actually is continues to be suitable, and we could expect an increase of 2% in to 2050 in terms of the rice production in that region. But the other side of the coin is wheat, for example, where you're producing these 90 tons. There we have a reduction of 5 to 10% in its potential productivity. And so that could cause serious issues of food security and implications not only for those that are growing it in the Indo-Gangetic Plains, but also the rest of India, which is eating that wheat, and so there it's a kind of mixed picture. You have some gains, you have some losses. In West Africa, we have some of the most important, some of the most major impacts. We're seeing important crops like soybean, potato, wheat and sorghum all losing out, which are important crops for that region. But then also some gains, and the crops that are benefiting from the different climate are mainly the more robust ones. So you have things like sugar cane, you have plantain and bananas, white yam, sweet potatoes. So those roots and tubers have that capacity to overcome some of the higher temperatures or some of the short-term droughts and continue producing. And so, again, it's a picture of winners and losers. In East Africa, a similar pattern. You have crops like cassava and millet increasing in the potential productivity. Things like bean, which is the protein for the poor, they call it in that region, losing out with 3 to 5% decreases in productivity. Similarly for potato. So you have a question of crops. There's no single region where all crops are losing productivity, but the very specificities of those areas where people are depending on very specific crops for their food security, in many cases that crop that they're growing today is going to lose out in the future. So the emerging pattern is the need for crop substitution in the long term, so that societies and cultures locally need to adapt by also changing their cultural practices by growing different crops to what they grow today. And so that obviously is quite an upheaval for those communities and something that we need to work towards and try to avoid if possible. So research can provide some of the answers, so it can provide new varieties that are more resistant. But if climate change is too severe for those crops to be continue growing, then we need to work on substitution. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jarvis. Our next speaker is Dr. Phil Thornton, and he's senior scientist at the International Livestock Research Institute. Go ahead, Phil.
Thank you, and good morning, good afternoon, everybody. And just to follow on from some of the problems that Andy has just identified, there are many options that can be undertaken to try to help vulnerable people cope with some of these problems. But first, perhaps just a word about what the target clients will be for this CCAS program. In many ways, it's really directed at smallholders. And so these are people in the initial target regions of CCAS, which is Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. These are smallholders who have both crops and livestock and who are dependent on both for their livelihoods. And of course, in developing country situations, livestock often have multiple roles. So it's not only the production of meat and milk, but livestock also are a form of asset, and manure is an important source of nutrients for crops, and of course in some systems livestock are a source of traction. So there's a big distinction between the livestock systems in developing countries with those that we're familiar with in the developed world. So what are some of the options then that CCAS will be looking at? Well, there are many adaptation options, and these are things that could help smallholders to adapt to a changing climate. Andy already mentioned the possibility of breeding and coming up with new varieties of particular crops that are drought tolerant and heat tolerant. We know that temperatures are likely to increase over the coming decades, so coming up with varieties that can withstand the heat better. We also know that weather is likely to become more variable in the future, and so droughts and floods are likely to be more frequent. And so coming up with crops that are better able to withstand drought is one option. In some places, the changes may be quite severe, and then we may be looking at, as Andy also mentioned, the substitution of one crop for another, so perhaps moving from crops that like more quantities of water, such as maize, to more drought-tolerant ones, such as the sorghums and millets. And in fact, in places, there may be some places where cropping will become increasingly risky in the coming decades, and then smallholders may need to place more reliance on the livestock part of their smallholding in the future. There are also some other adaptation options, such as index-based livestock insurance schemes, which can be used using indicators based on remote sensing or weather forecasting to try to protect vulnerable livestock populations in times of drought. There are also examples of moving perhaps species from cattle and sheep to goats and camels, and goats and camels are better able to withstand dry conditions. Then there are also options for mitigating greenhouse gas emissions. As has already been mentioned, agriculture is part of the problem in terms of the emission of greenhouse gases, but it can also be part of the solution as well. And greenhouse gas emissions are of particular concern from livestock operations in tropical countries. But these could be cut significantly by various things such as changing diets and breeds and improving degraded lands on which they graze. So, for example, by switching to more nutritious pasture grasses or supplementing diets with even small amounts of crop residue or grains, and it's possible to reduce the amount of greenhouse gas emitted per kilo of livestock product. And so, for example, by switching from natural grasslands to sown pastures, then it's possible to increase daily milk production and weight gain by up to a factor of 3 quite easily. And with this kind of increase in productivity, it means that you would need fewer animals to satisfy a particular demand. And finally, there are also some options that have a role for both adaptation and mitigation. One example of this is the use of some agroforestry species. So on some small holdings, you can plant nitrogen-fixing trees. You can feed the leaves of the trees to cattle, which can increase production and raise farm income. At the same time, the trees absorb or sequester more carbon than would otherwise be absorbed. So if you can link smallholders into global and regional carbon markets, you can pay them for the carbon that they're taking out of the atmosphere and storing on their farm, in effect. So increase incomes, this will increase incomes even more and to help to diversify incomes as one form of adaptation and mitigation. And various schemes are underway in some places to try this, and CCAS will be trying to look at this in more detail. So these are just some of the alternative options that can be looked at, that can be looked into to try to help vulnerable people adapt to a changing climate and to help mitigate greenhouse gas emissions from tropical agriculture. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Thornton. Our last speaker is Dr. Jerry Nelson, who, again, he's Senior Research Fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute. Go ahead, Dr. Nelson.
Also, I should add, I'm a team leader in the CCAS program as well. Let me kind of bring us back to the big picture. I think we need to reemphasize the fact that the food security challenge facing us, us being humans in this case, is large. There's a growing world population, most of which will be growing in the developing world, and it's likely to stabilize around 9 billion people in 2050. That is, for every two people on the planet today, there will be an additional person in 2050. Most of those people will be in today's developing countries. We expect, and indeed we hope, that their income will be substantially higher than it is now, which will mean demand for more and higher quality food. The consequence of these demographic and economic changes is more pressure on sustainable food production. One indicator of that is higher crop prices. Last year in our 2009 food policy report, released from IFPRI in late September, we emphasized the fact that the price declines of the 20th century would likely be reversed in the 21st century. The results from our new publication, which will be released concurrently in Washington, D.C. and Cancun on December 1, reinforced that result of higher prices because of higher incomes and more people. And our press relations person, Michael Rubenstein, will be providing you with an embargoed copy of that report shortly. On top of the food security challenges coming from income and higher population, climate change is a threat multiplier. Even for those farmers that happen to be lucky enough to live in places that climate change will change their increase in productivity, they will still be needing to use resources for adjustment. And those resources could have been used for increasing the productivity that will be needed to meet the food security challenges. As other speakers have mentioned, agriculture contributes to climate change, and it must be part of the solution. About one-third of the total GHG emissions, the difference between that number and the one Bruce quoted is given by the fact that agriculture contributes to deforestation. One-third of the greenhouse gas emissions are from agriculture, broadly defined. Agriculture must become carbon negative. It must not only eliminate its own emissions, but it must capture part of the CO2 emitted from other sectors of the economy. The technical potential for this is huge, both above ground and below ground in terms of soil carbon. But the economic challenges to achieving this potential are also huge. These remain significantly large research topics that CCAS needs to and will be addressing. Out of these challenges, the food security challenge, the climate change multiplier, come three main categories of policy implications. The first is that policies that encourage broad-based, sustainable economic growth today are critical for resilience to climate change. Farmers, poor people, urban dwellers who have higher incomes are more able to deal with whatever uncertainties the climate and other economic changes throw at them. The second category of policy implications is the need for investments in agricultural productivity, better crops, improved management systems, more and better irrigation systems that use water more efficiently, the expansion of rural roads. These are all needed in order to deal with the challenges facing us both from food security and climate change. We need government programs that level the playing field for rural people in terms of institutional change and access to infrastructure, and indeed raise it so that they can become more productive and lead better lives. And finally, we need to have an open international trading system to compensate for the expected increased variability in agricultural production. We've focused in this series of presentations on the challenges facing us to 2050. those challenges are large, but at least the one conclusion that we come to at IFPRI in our upcoming report is that they are manageable if we begin to act now. The challenges beyond 2050 are significantly greater. We can expect to see productivity declines between now and 2050 on the order of 10 to 30% depending upon crop and location. But when you look out to 2080 and 2050, if we don't mitigate greenhouse gases, if we don't slow the climate change increases in temperature and the changes in precipitation patterns, it becomes an almost impossible challenge to deal with the food security and climate change threats facing us. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Nelson. We'll now take questions. I'll direct questions to the most knowledgeable expert unless you state a preference. You'll have a chance to ask a follow-up question after your first one. The operator will now explain how to queue up for questions. Operator, please go ahead.
Thank you. And at this time, if you would like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Please keep in mind that you may remove yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, that's star and one if you would like to ask a question. And it looks like our first question comes from the site of Jeff Tolson with Nature Magazine. Your line is open.
Hi there. I guess I'm curious about the what this means in Cancun. There have been a lot of discussions about trying to integrate agriculture. You had mentioned, Bruce, that there was some language in there kind of opening the door to a work program. Can you talk about that a little bit more? And can you talk about kind of specific goals about where we go next?
Thanks, Bruce. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, if you search the current text, then there's mentions of food security in a number of places, just in terms of the need for adaptation. There's a very specific chapter which relates to agriculture. So it's a whole chapter on agriculture. It's very small, and it's right at the end. And within that, it reiterates the importance of agriculture, and it mentions that a work program for agriculture should be initiated. That's the kind of language that is needed to open the door. In the first round of negotiations, you'd never expect anything more than that. Essentially, the work program then goes through the details of, well, how exactly is agriculture going to be incorporated, and there's a process of doing that. So it's essentially the door opening for agriculture. And then many people have got ideas about what should be in the work program and the kinds of issues that it should tackle and what the eventual regime should look like. And those are some of the actions which would follow immediately from Cancun. So those are the things that we will also be looking at during Agricultural Day, trying to deliberate on exactly the kinds of issues that need to be tackled in the next few months to make agriculture part of the global regime. I think we're also because of the nervousness about whether anything happens in Cancun, we're also thinking at Agriculture Day, we're also thinking how we can incorporate that kind of thinking about what's next into other processes.
I'm assuming that part of the idea is to kind of build off the progress that has been made under RED, right? Because even the RED advocates say that you can't entirely deal with deforestation without dealing with agriculture.
That's correct. And one actual problem for agriculture is that it's coming after RED, and that people are now seeing how difficult it is to deal with RED. And therefore, one throws up their hands and say, oh, my goodness, that's not include agriculture because that is going to create more complexities. But as you pointed out, at least half of forestry emissions come from conversion due to agriculture. So I guess another place where you may see agriculture getting a piece of action would be within the RED agreements, where incentives are now put in place in terms of perhaps intensifying agriculture rather than letting extensification happen. But I should just notice that we're working together with the Forest Day people. There's also a big day in Cancun on Forest Day, and we've got mutual joint events so that we can try and tackle this interaction between forestry and agriculture.
Okay, let's take the next question.
Absolutely. It looks like our next question comes from the site of Charles Hanley with the Associated Press. Your line is open.
Thank you. I'm just wondering whether any of you can cite any current examples of any current evidence of impacts of warming on particular crops in particular regions.
I can give that a go. This is Andy Jarvis.
Is that Dr. Andy Jarvis?
Yep, this is Andy. We were just literally last week in India, in the Indo-Gangetic Plains, and there we were hearing from farmers themselves telling us about some of their problems. It's a fascinating story that they have. So in the wheat season, they grow wheat during kind of the winter, the so-called winter, which is planting right now and harvesting around March time. And what they've been, all of the farmers themselves said this without us urging them to tell us about a climate change story, but they're all saying in March they're having problems, and that's because in March the grain is filling, so that means the wheat, the actual the grains are essentially all of the energy of the plant is going towards creating the largest grains. And so in March, the temperatures are quite high, and wheat's very sensitive during that period to high temperatures. And they're getting reduced yields because of those high temperatures. And so what farmers are trying to do there is plant earlier so that essentially they harvest the crop a little bit before those high temperatures start hitting, which then has very knock-on effects on all sorts of other things, like the rice cycle is from June through to October. And so if they need to move forward the wheat, they also need to move forward the rice, but then there are problems with irrigation. So it's quite a complex system, but they're feeling the bite, especially with wheat.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go to the next question, please.
And it looks like our next question comes from the site of Ben Sills with Bloomberg. Your line is open.
Hi. I'm just wondering, could you just run me through the some of the practicalities of this again? I mean, so I heard, I think, Bruce, you said at the beginning it was $300 million over 10 years. Is that the total budget for this program, and who's paying for this? Thanks.
Bruce, go ahead.
Hi. It's $200 million over 3 years, but it's a predicted 10-year program.
Okay.
So roughly, you know, at the start, it's about $50 million growing in the first few years. And the investors, it's the international community. It includes the World Bank, EFID, USAID. So it includes all the major donors in the world. Amongst the group, there are some developing countries that form part of the CGIAR, so I think it's India, China, Brazil, all members.
Great, thanks.
Let's take the next question.
Absolutely. Our next question comes from the site of Lori Gore with Thomson Reuters. Your line is open.
Hi, I was hearing a couple of contradictory figures earlier. Andy, you had mentioned that by 2050 there is a decrease of 5 to 10%, was it overall or in a particular crop? And Jerry, you had said that in 2050 we can expect 20 to 30% crop declines. I just wanted to make sure I understood exactly what the right number is. And Jerry, you also said between 2050 and 2080 things just get out of control. Do you have any sense of how much the declines are over that period, or is that just too unknown at this point?
Why don't we take Dr. Andy Jarvis first and then Dr. Jerry Nelson?
This is the dangers of climate change. So the difference, again, the difference is down to the two numbers are saying different things, actually. The numbers I was saying, this is the climatic potential to produce food. And so that's assuming that, for example, we start growing things like maize in Siberian forests. This is essentially with maximum adaptation, growing food wherever you can. Jerry's numbers are much more realistic in terms of looking at how climate change will impact on current crop land and looking to 2050 and beyond. Maybe Jerry could have something else to say.
Okay, go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, it is this issue of trying to figure out how to present a few numbers. Let me give you some more details that are coming out in this report that we're releasing on December 1. What we do is we use some crop modeling software to grow crops around the world with today's conditions, and that includes soil characteristics, our assumptions about fertilizer use, and today's rainfall and temperature distribution patterns. And then what we do is replace climate variables, temperature and precipitation, which we have on monthly intervals, which we then have to convert to daily results, and we do that with a weather generator. So we take the 2000 results, and then we take the same kind of inputs, except that we replace them with 2050 weather climate, I mean coming out of the climate models, and with 2080 climate. So it's a purely biophysical effect. It doesn't take into account that between now and 2050 there will be substantial investments in productivity of various kinds and the adaptation that Andy was talking about. But purely with these biophysical effects using, and again, the climate models give you different results as well. So with the Australian climate model, the CSIRO model, with the A2 stress scenario, looking at wheat, we find that, again, averaging up to the developing world, which of course includes a large number of places, we find that the decline in grain-fed yields between 2000 and 2030 is on the order of 2%. 2.2% is what the report will say. And for irrigated yields, the decline is actually 9%, and that's because of the change in distribution between the grain-fed locations and the irrigated locations. If you go out to 2050, this result is an increase in the yields go from a decline of 2% to 4% for rain-fed wheat. But if you go out to 2080, the decline is 18.6%. And you get similar sorts of big magnitude changes for the irrigated agriculture as well. So we've done those estimates just for wheat for 2080. We'll be doing them for other crops for 2080. But so the 2050 numbers, which is what we report in our report, that, again, aggregated, but will provide much more detailed numbers for those people who are interested in seeing what's going on in their country, will provide on a website that will have substantially more detail than we've ever released before. How's that do?
Thanks very much for the help.
Great. Operator, do we have any other questions?
And it appears that we have no further questions at this time.
Okay, so if anyone wants to ask any other questions, now is the time. We'll wait a second.
It looks like we do have another question in the queue.
Okay, let's go ahead.
Okay, it comes from the site of John Parker with The Economist. Your line is open.
Just one follow-up question to the last question. Jerry, you, about a year or two ago, did do a kind of initial study looking at those yields up to 2020, I think, or 2050, using the Australian site and using that Australian model and another model. How are your new results, how do they compare with the former results?
Well, so the short answer to that question, John, is that there's actually a section in the report which compares our 2009 to our 2000.
Oh, okay.
Well, let me tell you what we've done differently, a few details of what we've done differently. And differently is we're using the MIROC model, the Japanese GCM, CSIRO. The Japanese model is interesting in that while it has more precipitation on average on land than the CSIRO model, it also has more uneven distribution. So the Corn Belt of the United States gets a substantial hit from the reduction in precipitation. So we actually see big declines in maize and soybean productions in the United States, declines relative to what they are in the CSIRO model. We've done more sophisticated use of the crop models than we have in the past. We've also incorporated a lot more plausible scenarios about economic and population futures.
Thank you.
Actually end up with 15 different potential plausible results, and we have to figure out how to present those.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any other questions, operator? I'll take one more.
It appears that we have no further questions.
Okay. Thanks, everyone, for attending this briefing. Please call Megan Dold if you have follow-up questions or would like a one-on-one interview. The number is 1-301-280-5720. Again, the online press kit, it's at ccaf.cgiar.org/content/press-room. The audio briefing of the call will be available starting at noon Eastern Time today through Sunday. You can access it by calling 1-800-839-2486. International callers should dial 1-402-220-7223. Thanks again to everyone for participating in this call.
And this does conclude today's teleconference. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at any time and have a wonderful day.